It's time for a solid hour of Tea Party Power. And now, here's Janine Garofalo's favorite tea-bagging redneck, Mark Gillar.
Welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. I am Mark Gillar. My special guest today, David Ferdoso. He is a political reporter for the Washington Examiner and the author of the New York Times best-selling book, The Case Against Barack Obama. Previously, he covered Capitol Hill for National Review Online and was a reporter for Human Events. His latest book is entitled Gangster Government, Barack Obama and the New Washington Thugocracy. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm about 100 pages into the book. I'm loving every minute of it. I think you've got another bestseller on your hands.
Thank you.
I'm guessing sales have been brisk thus far?
They have, yeah. They're doing well.
Glad to hear that. You're covering a lot of topics in this book that should make a major difference in the next election if people pay attention to it. Do you think this book could have an impact on the next election?
Well, I mean, I'd like to think so, except, you know, you've always got the problem. You look back at the last election, I wrote a book then, it sold an awful lot of copies, but I'm afraid not enough people listened, so you just never know. At the very least, I feel like we can try to inform people, and this is one way of doing it, you know?
Let's dive right in. I'd like to begin with the GM and Chrysler bailouts. Talk to us about how some of the activities that surrounded the GM and Chrysler bailouts fall within the category of an Obama thugocracy.
Well, you know, the entire idea gangster government, that phrase was first used of the Obama administration by my colleague Michael Barone, who was kind enough to write the foreword for gangster government. He saw what was going on with the secured creditors of Chrysler essentially being shaken down by the Obama administration, being told, we're taking your money away in this sort of sham bankruptcy process that we're going to push forward, and we're going to give it to a politically favored labor union. And if you resist us, then we will smear and vilify you using the White House as a platform in both public and private. And that's exactly what happened. And it's just a terrible, you know, you look at what happened there, and basically you're using the tools of government to expand your own power, because there's certainly no power enumerated in our Constitution to take ownership of an auto company or to manipulate the bankruptcy process the way the executive branch did in this case. And so they're trampling on the rule of law, expanding their own power, and at the same time helping friends and punishing enemies. And that's what the Obama administration has been all about, is helping friends and punishing enemies.
Well, let's talk about exactly how he did that. Now, one of the things you point out in the book is that this is one of the most bizarre cases in terms of bankruptcy court that anybody has ever seen. It basically reversed 100 years of bankruptcy law because unsecured creditors were given preference over secured creditors.
Right. No, that's exactly right. And in fact, two well-known academics published a paper in the University of Michigan Law Review. These are legal scholars who basically said this reverses 100 years of bankruptcy law and takes us back to the 19th century, when you would have management of companies that were going under would bring their friends along into a new company, which they would basically loot the company, bring their friends along, and leave certain other creditors out. And this is the reason the modern bankruptcy code was developed, was precisely to prevent this kind of abuse. But the Obama administration essentially facilitated that very kind of abuse, because that's what happened with Chrysler. I mean, you take a look at it, they left those secured creditors out in the cold, and they brought their friends who were unsecured creditors, the UAW, the Auto Workers Union, they brought them along into the new company. So, and the way that bankruptcy worked, it would be technically incorrect to say that Chrysler went into bankruptcy, because what actually happened is that Chrysler, the government created a shell company called New Chrysler, and they sold everything that was worth having from old Chrysler to New Chrysler for a song, and then old Chrysler went into bankruptcy. New Chrysler was just this company that had bought all of this stuff in a sort of controlled sale where no one was dealing at arm's length, where other potential buyers were kept out by the rules of the game that involved the union having to sign off on it, and you ended up with a legal sham. The way they described it was, this was no more a sale than taking your wallet out of one pocket and putting it into another and maybe losing a couple dollars on the way. It's not a sale any more than that would be a sale.
Well, now, one of the things you mentioned is that the UAW and some other people were actually put on the board to take a look at other offers. So there was really no chance of other offers being given serious consideration. Is that correct?
No, that's exactly right. I mean, and, you know, people point out, well, why aren't there other people lining up to buy this if this sale is being done so cheaply? Well, the reason is that they boxed out the other potential buyers. No one can come in and buy this stuff if the UAW and the Obama administration, the Treasury Department, have to sign off on it. So what you had here was simply, first of all, a bailout, which it's kind of an offensive idea, really, when you think about it. This was something that was not authorized by law at all. It's something that, you know, and the Bush administration bears some blame for this, too, for extending the original loans without any legal authorization. But they did this, you know, they used TARP as a justification, which requires them to determine, the Secretary of Treasury has to determine that GM and Chrysler are financial institutions, because that's the way the law is worded. And the definition of financial institutions in TARP says including but not limited to, which basically means anything can be a financial institution. So this administration was given a blank check, and they took majority ownership of one auto company, and they pushed both of them into these sham bankruptcies. And especially in the Chrysler case, we came out with a deal where we've spent over $12 billion bailing out a company that's only worth $5 billion. I mean, tell me how that makes any economic sense. But then look at what they've done to the Constitution and the rule of law. They've set this horrible, horrible precedent where the government is just going to jump in and save bad companies when their assets would produce more for the economy probably if they were sold to someone who actually knew what they were doing and wasn't bound and tied down to these union contracts that had ridiculous work rules that had run these companies into bankruptcy in the first place.
Well, let me jump in with two things. First of all, you pointed out very, very astutely in the book that one of the reasons we didn't hear a whole lot of griping from the secured creditors is that they themselves were receiving TARP funds, and they were being bailed out.
No, the big guys who had secured Chrysler debt, the J.P. Morgans of the world, et cetera, Goldman Sachs, they were getting much more from TARP than they would by collecting what was owed to them in this deal. And so, yeah, they basically didn't complain. The Obama administration used that as leverage against them. And then the smaller secured creditors were the ones who ended up getting denounced and vilified by President Obama in his just infamous speech of April 30th, 2009, where he called them vultures and he said that they were a bunch of scavengers who were, you know, angling to get a government bailout. Well, no, I mean, they were angling for the law to actually be obeyed is what they were angling for, and they were angling for a little bit more of what they were technically owed regardless of you know, whether the company went into bankruptcy or not. So the entire thing is it's just a really sorry episode in our nation's history. It's amazing to me that the Obama administration now wants to turn this into a selling point for them in the next election. If I detail the way that the bankruptcy and the bailout went down in gangster government, but if you want to get some sort of an updated view of all this, you should check out our Friday editorial in the Washington Examiner, which looks at why, you know, even though they're saying now, well, Chrysler paid back all the loans, that's really not true. What they're doing is they're taking out more federal loans and in order to get rid of the current ones they have and refinance at a lower interest rate. And in the meantime, taxpayers are still being hung out to dry with both of these auto companies.
You mentioned in the book that, and you said this a few seconds ago, that if the market had been allowed to work and those assets could have gone to other companies, you know, we'll never know the foregone opportunity cost of just allowing the market to work and those assets to be divided up, including the human assets, the human resources there. And you referenced Bastier, or some people say Bastia. Talk to the listeners about that as far as how, if the market had been allowed to work, we probably would have seen much more come out of this.
Right. Well, you know, the thing is we don't know, and I don't want to argue this strictly based on results. I think the results would have been better. And yes, a lot of these auto workers would have found jobs with new companies that would have developed, because the demand for automobiles wasn't just going to go away when the auto companies disappeared. That's not true at all. So you were going to have a market for someone to come in, buy the assets of these companies that were worth having, and produce cars. And there was going to be a market for auto workers to be hired too. But the bigger problem, like you said, is that we can't know the cost of that. Bastiat writes about what the, you know, the lost opportunity costs are never visible because it's easy to go and tell auto workers, I saved your job. It's a lot harder to point to the victim in this, who is someone who could have produced something, people who could have been hired if we weren't using societal resources to prop up bad companies that didn't know how to run themselves. And that's this is the famous broken window fallacy, where people, a little boy breaks a window in the town, and then because the owner of the shop has to buy a new window, people say, oh, that helped the economy. Well, that's not true at all, because that money would have been used for better things, presumably, had the boy not broken the window. And so we're basically throwing money into these bad companies and pretending like, oh, this helps the economy, we're creating jobs. Well, no, you're not creating jobs. You're actually just compounding the problems. Now we have these companies that they should succeed because they've had so much debt removed from them. They should be succeeding. And in fact, they're not really doing very well. They're producing cars that people don't like. They were at the bottom of the consumer reports list. And then, you know, GM just reported these record profits, but the only reason they had profits, it wasn't because of the cars they were selling. It was because of a one-time sale of one of their subsidiary companies, which they were able to make money on because the government had bailed out that company's pensions. I'm talking about Delphi, which gets a mention in Gangster Government, too. So, you know, and throughout this entire process, another interesting thing to look at is how the union was given special treatment. I mean, the UAW had 700,000 members in 2001, and by 2009 they had 350,000 members. And if these companies hadn't been bailed out, they would probably have 150,000 members or less. Obama has basically given them a lifeline for now. As long as these companies can be kept on life support and propped up, he is going to continue to have this source of support and organized network of people who will get out the vote for him in states like Michigan and Ohio.
Speaking of Delphi, I think one of the most damning pieces of evidence that this was all about saving the unions and not about saving Chrysler or GM is you mentioned that when you talk about bailing out the pensions of Delphi, that only the UAW workers who worked for Delphi got that benefit. If you were a non-Delphi employee, you were essentially screwed.
No, that's right. We have a system in the United States called the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. The companies that give defined benefit pensions pay into this thing. And then when some pensions go belly up, they cover part of it. But the problem is that they don't cover that much. I mean, people's pensions, if it gets handed over to the PBGC, they can lose a lot of their pension because of that. And that's what happened to the non-union workers at Delphi. The union workers, the government came in and poured all of this money in so that GM could bail out the unionists. So it's this disparity of treatment. Again, helping friends, punishing enemies, people getting unjustifiable payouts when everyone else is hurting. That's what really is at the crux of gangster government. We've just seen it again and again. And, the auto bailout is probably the clearest and best example because there was so much thuggery going on. There was so much lawlessness going on. But throughout the administration, you see a similar pattern, whether you're looking at the stimulus package, whether you're looking at the just kind of unjustifiable help that this administration is giving to the tri-lawyer lobby, a very generous donor to the Democratic Party. These are all cases in which, you know, gangster government is clearly happening and just constantly going on right in front of us.
One of the things that this book did, frankly, was make me feel kind of silly because after the bailout, you saw all these bumper stickers that said balance the budget by a Ford, and Ford was running these commercials saying they didn't take any bailout money. I'm among those people who went out and got a Ford, and now I read your book and I find out they were getting bailout money under the radar.
Well, yeah, that's right. I mean, Ford was a better managed company, and they didn't need the top-to-bottom restructuring that they didn't need a sham bankruptcy from the Obama administration. But they did get large loans that Chrysler and GM were not eligible for that you could point to as, you know, certainly they just got a smaller bailout if you look at those. This Department of Energy loan, they were getting Export-Import Bank was giving them loan guarantees for exports to Mexico, which was basically just a flat-out subsidy because, you know, the guarantee didn't come with the condition that they actually sell any more cars in Mexico. It just came with, you know, this is just the government backing up Ford's business operations, which is why you didn't hear a lot of objections from Ford while GM and Chrysler were being bailed out. I mean, the case was very strong, especially for Chrysler, to just let it fail, because that would have helped GM and Ford be more viable companies. And in fact, this was an argument that they were having in the White House. If you read the book by Obama's auto czar, he just flat out says, you know, there wasn't really a good economic case for saving Chrysler. It was more of a political and a social case for saving it. But they saved it anyway. And that, you know, you paid for it and you're still paying for it. And there's no way the taxpayers ever going to break even on these automakers either. So that's a lot of money down the drain, a lot of opportunity costs. And again, when government supports inefficient companies, it hurts the economy by definition, because that means that resources are going to be allocated to things that people don't want or that aren't worth the price that people, you know, would have to pay for them.
You're talking, of course, about the car czar Steve Rattner.
And yeah, that's right.
One of the things I found interesting in the book is that he had made the reference that, well, you know, I can't remember if it was GM or Chrysler or both, you couldn't so much as tighten a screw if it was not in your job description. And my thought is,
right.
That sounds like more of a union deal than something the company would come up with.
Oh, no, that's exactly right. I mean, the unions, basically you had this case where a very complacent management had given away the store to the unions. And definitely you had a problem in terms of compensation when it comes to health care costs and pensions. They had given away way too much to the union. But the real problem is the work rules. The work rules at both Chrysler and GM are just so ridiculous, it's impossible for them to make money. They were not able to lay off workers, for example, when economic hard times came. And part of the reason they ended up in the situation they're in now, or that they came to be in 2009, is that they couldn't lay people off. So they started buying out older workers, which cost them a ton of money. If you laid people off, they still had to be paid 90% of their salary. So, you know, there's just no way for a company to survive under those kinds of conditions. It makes it impossible.
Tell our listeners what the rubber room is or was.
Yes, right. I mean, you've probably heard of rubber rooms in other contexts. In New York City, teachers are put into these rubber rooms if they're accused of some kind of misconduct or whatever. They get full pay. They just come in and sit there all day and don't do any work. Well, it's exactly the same thing. If you got laid off by Chrysler or GM, you would end up in one of these rubber rooms being paid 90% of your salary, and you could just sit around all day, maybe watch TV, draw up a resume so that you could apply for a job in another part of the company, and you could be there indefinitely. At least that's the way it was. One of the concessions that the union had to make was that the rubber room only lasts a couple years now, but that's still ridiculous. It's not a permanent benefit anymore, but it's a very long-term benefit that, you know, I'm sure a lot of people across America would love to be in a situation where they could extract so much from their company, then when it goes under, just get paid to do nothing, and or just get bailed out by the government. It's very unfair. It's just so unfair. And again, gangster government helps its friends and punishes its enemies.
Well, it sounds to me like if you put on your resume that you'd been in the rubber room for 2 years, it would be it would be a great way to get into a government job.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Now, I have to warn the listeners that it's almost impossible to read this book without getting a little mad, a little upset, a little angry. And one of the things, and I'm always honest with my listeners, I'm about halfway through the book, but one of the things that I really just became infuriated about was when I read that, I believe it was GM, actually used about $11.3 million of bailout money to lobby Congress while they were in bankruptcy.
No, that's right. And they never quit. Their lobbying operation had been running throughout the entire thing. And this is the sort of sad world that we're in. And this doesn't begin with Obama, although I think he's made it a lot worse. A lot of businesses, their main strategy now for business to make a profit is to lobby the government for handouts. And look at General Electric. I mean, they're getting a handout at every level of everything they do, and they do a lot of stuff. They have been for many years the largest corporate lobbying entity. There are some bigger trade groups that lobby, but they're the biggest corporation in terms of the amount of money spent lobbying. And as long as gangster government exists, you know, and gangster government is there helping friends and rewarding enemies, you're going to see lobbying explode. Because the more powerful government is, the more money government is doling out, the greater the consequences of failing to buy protection from the Obama administration, the more people are going to feel like they are compelled to spend on lobbying.
Well, I don't care if they want to spend money on lobbying, but...
And of course, right, in this case,
they're
spending your money on lobbying.
Exactly.
This is the kind of problem you create when you get in and bail out corporations. It is such a bad idea. It's bad for corporate governance because now federal government and the federal taxpayer feel like, well, now you're hurting me. And whenever the further government gets in, the more just a, you know, people taking responsibility for their own actions disappears because you have more political considerations governing the way a corporation is run instead of business considerations. And, you know, government should do government things. Business should do business things. It's a very simple principle. The world would be a better place if everyone adhered to it. There's a big difference between public and private that has to be respected. The public, the government, is supposed to be the arbiter, the guys who make the playing field level for everybody so that they can compete. The government doesn't look out for its own benefit. The government isn't there to make a profit, and that's the way it should be. The government is not and should not be like the private sector at all. Government is a disinterested party, and that's what good government is. Whereas private actors, whether it's a person or a corporation, they look for their own benefit. They look out for their family. They look out for their shareholders. That's what the private sector is supposed to do. And meanwhile, the government is supposed to prevent them from hurting other people and violating their rights. Well, this has been completely turned on its head by the Obama administration. And that's what gangster government does. In gangster government, first of all, you're creating an unlevel playing field on purpose. And second, you have a government that, because it's so deeply involved in private corporations and the way they're run, it now can justify further overreaches by saying, oh, well, now that we own GM, we have to get a better deal for the taxpayers, so we're going to make them act in certain irrational ways that don't make any business sense. And that's what's happened with these companies ever since they were bailed out. Steve Rattner writes about it in The AutoZar. He writes about it in his book Overhaul, about how certain things that might have been good business ideas they had to reject because politically it would be unpalatable, for example, for GM to be doing certain things with its foreign subsidiaries. And these were deals, he said, where, yeah, they might have actually made some money, but because you have all this political interest now in their runnings, it was not really being run like a business anymore.
I seem to recall that his test, whether or not he did something, was the Washington Post test.
That's right. He would ask himself, if this ends up as a headline on the front page of the Washington Post, is this going to embarrass the Obama administration? I mean, Ratner's book is really good. He's very forthright about all this stuff. Another thing that he said was he thanked heaven that Congress did not get involved at all, that Congress had no oversight over this. Congress did not authorize any of it. He said if we'd had Congress involved overseeing what we were doing, we would have just been subjected to constant political interference from them, and it would have just been a huge mess, which is really amazing to read. You know, as someone who got at least something of a civics education, popular Democratic involvement in the activity of government seems like a bedrock of our republic. I mean, the more the people are involved, the better. That's why Congress is required to spend money. You know, you can't do it without congressional authorization. That's why we have representative democracy in the Congress. That's why we have a Congress. That's why we have separate branches of government. The whole idea here is for people to be more involved. And Steve Rattner is just so happy that that the people were not involved, that government bureaucrats could make all the important decisions without interference from the elected representatives of the people of the United States of America.
Not to mention that he was, in fact, a czar who, I'm guessing, didn't go through the congressional approval process.
Well, you know, people make a lot of czars, and, you know, there are good czars, there are bad czars. Maybe all czars should be eliminated. Now, the Obama administration did not invent the czar, and it's important for people to understand that. And not all czars are not confirmed by Congress. So the idea of the czar, and I love the jokes about how the Obama administration has more czars than the Romanov dynasty and all that. But the important thing is when people are unaccountable, when they're not behaving in a way that shows that they have the public trust. Steve Rattner and Barack Obama and Tim Geithner were running the government as if they owned the country. And that's just wrong. The government, Rattner writes about how government should look more like the private sector, and that's precisely the mentality that I think is so wrong with gangster government. is that here they were, what they were doing was running the country as if they owned it without having to consult with the actual owners, which is the people of America.
Let's take in the few minutes we have left, and we barely scratched the surface here. I wanted to get into the whole health care bill. I guess what we can say about that is that when you looked at the health care bill, if it's such a great deal, why was the waiver used as a political payoff for all the unions who supported Barack Obama?
You know, it's not so much that the waivers are being granted disproportionately to unions, which they are, and I believe now that over 50% of the workers covered by these waivers are union workers. The real sort of scandal goes back further. It's the fact that this exception was created specifically to help the union. And the Obama administration doesn't mind coming in and crushing you and your current insurance arrangement, but it has to give the union a few years to get ready and renegotiate everything. And that's why the unions were given the opportunity to seek these waivers, which are specifically designed for the kind of health care plans they tend to negotiate. That's why the unions were exempted from paying the Cadillac tax that was put into the bill to pay for part of it. I mean, the union were basically given this great opportunity to have this bill that was going to allow them to now turn around and demand bigger wages, and at the same time they were exempted from the obligation of paying for it, and they're also exempted from a lot of its requirements for the first few years because of these specifically union-designed provisions.
I'm interested how in the world we can take $500 billion out of Medicare when this bill lacked certain provisions that George Bush's Medicare Part D drug prescription bill had that kept companies from having the incentive to dump patients or employees into the Medicare program.
I'm sorry, in the Medicare program?
Well, no, yeah. You were saying in the book that the Medicare Part D program Bush had.
Oh, yes. That's right. Because when, the prescription drug benefit, part of the deal, you know, and that's something that was, can't imagine how anyone can look at that as anything but a mistake at this point. The problem was that in order to make that work, they basically, right, they had to prevent these companies from dumping their workers into it. So they basically gave them a subsidy. And the Obamacare basically was going to go back on that, and the result was going to be that a lot of people were going to be dumped onto the government. And the subsidy cost the government less than actually having these people getting served by the Medicare Part D program. And so it just really goes to show you that people who don't know what they're doing when they write a bill and they don't read what's in the bill, you know, that's another part of gangster government, is you just have these things being rammed through. Nobody read it. Nobody knew it was in it. People still, you know, people who voted for it and still talk about what's in it, and they're not correct because they didn't read it and they don't know what's in it. And that's just the travesty of Obamacare.
Well, as Nancy Pelosi said, you had to pass the thing to see what was in it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we're all gonna see what's in it, and we're not gonna be very happy. I am quite certain of that.
I think you had mentioned, and I know we're about out of time, but I think you had mentioned in the book that a district court judge really just had fun making fun of Obamacare and mentioning that was there something like 400 issues tackled by Obamacare that don't have anything to do with health care?
Exactly. That was his huge laugh that he put into there. And I thought it was hysterical to read his decision precisely because he wrote, you know, it's so funny to read this thing, and I quote from it at length in Gangster Government, why his justification basically for not striking down the entire bill was that there's so much just extraneous material in there that has nothing to do with healthcare that there's no justification for striking it all down because a lot of it just doesn't fit.
Well, the provision that the bill should have contained that would have kept striking down part of it from striking down the entire thing wasn't in there because I guess whoever wrote Obamacare didn't know what they were doing. Is that correct?
No, the whole thing, it was done in such a way that, I mean, people, it wasn't just a case of hiding things in the bill. There was a lot of that. But it was also just a case of dumb, boneheaded, simple mistakes in drafting. The way they wrote the bill, there was no severance clause in there to make sure that the bill would stay together. There was, they had made all these big promises about how they were going to cover children with pre-existing conditions. And the way they actually wrote the bill, It wasn't in there. And this was something that people pointed out after it passed. They said, you used the wrong words here, and as a result, the law doesn't mean what you've been saying it means. They had to, basically, the Obama administration had to scramble and get insurance companies to agree to do this without being legally required, because their law that they drafted didn't do what it was supposed to do. It's just a, you know, one among many, many signs of what a bad, bad mistake this was.
And it also violated one of Obama's biggest campaign promises, because he promised not to tax people making under $250,000 a year. And in fact, even though he said it was not a tax when he was talking to George Stephanopoulos, whenever the Obama administration lawyers got into court and started trying to defend this thing, the first thing they said was, hey, it falls under our right to tax. As far as the mandate to buy insurance.
Well, that's the, you know, this is the argument in the alternative that they have in front of the court now. They're trying to argue that they're allowed to do this, and force people to buy insurance based on the Interstate Commerce Clause. But if that argument fails, they say, well, in that case, we're going to argue that it's actually a tax, and the federal government under the Constitution has the power to tax. So no court has bought this so far. The court that's hearing it now, the Fourth Circuit, is asking for briefs about this that make it look to some people like they might decide it's a tax. But that's something that even the courts that upheld Obamacare, they never accepted that argument. They thought it was a bad argument, and it is. If you look at what the precedent is, the Supreme Court precedent for what is a tax, this does not fit the definition. This is a penalty. So this is the mandate is a law that says you have to do something. It is not a tax that says you get taxed if you don't do something.
Tell the listeners how they can get a hold of a copy of your book.
Well, they can get Gangster Government at Amazon.com or at any fine bookstore nearby, or you can go to GangsterGovernmentBook.com and you can get a free chapter and you can buy it through there.
David, it has been a real pleasure having you here today. Again, I'm about 100 pages into the book. It is a real eye-opener, and I would encourage all my listeners to grab a copy and read it from cover to cover. I am going to throw up some links to Amazon.com and any place else I can find that is selling the book, and we'll try to help direct our listeners to a place where they can buy the book that way. But thank you for spending some time with us today. Very enlightening, and I think without question you've got another New York Times bestseller on your hands.
Well, thank you, sir. Thanks very much.